It's with a traditional chanting homage to the Buddha. For those that know it, please feel free to follow along. I'll do it in Pali and then in translation in English. Those that are not familiar with it, you can just follow along in your heart. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Homage to the blessed, noble, and perfectly enlightened one. Homage to the blessed, noble, and perfectly enlightened one. Homage to the blessed, noble, and perfectly enlightened one. Welcome, everyone, this evening. It's wonderful to see so many people here and take time out from what I can only assume are busy lives. I don't know many people these days that don't have some form of busyness in their lives. It's always a great joy to be able to have these opportunities to share from the experiences of my life. I've been out of the monastery for 11 years now, going on 12 years, and I think one of the things that I miss the most is the being surrounded in a way, in a very constant way, by people who are sincerely interested in awakening and realizing truth and practicing a path of self-awareness and self-awakening. And as I'm sure everyone is aware, as we walk around the streets and the neighborhoods where we live, we see far too little of this. There are far too little examples around us of enlightened behavior, to say the least. The topic I've chose for this evening, I just recently gave a talk at a day-long retreat on this same five themes at New York Insight Meditation Center in Manhattan Saturday. And they're themes that are very, very powerful. I find very powerful, and I think as I speak through them this evening, that it's my hope that can impart what these themes kind of mean in our lives, and as we find them handed down scripturally in the Buddhist teachings. I have a handout. I'll wait rather than to kind of distract handing out that you can get at the end of the evening. I have about 30 or so. So if you have a friend that you know you can get a copy for, perhaps just share one between you. I kind of was thinking 30-ish this evening, and it looks like quite a few more than 30, or at least a few more than 30. It's important to understand in Buddhist teaching and philosophy, I think the difference between prayer or praying to something and a reflection or a contemplation. And we find in the Buddhist tradition this encouragement to contemplate, to reflect on things. And what is contemplation or reflection? I think of it as, I think one of the nicest maybe analogies is the idea of reflection, like looking in a clear pond and seeing one's reflection. When you see a reflection, even in a mirror, but maybe more so in a pond because it's not quite so lucid, rather than think about your reflection, I think you feel your reflection. And right at the moment, that's the best that I can come up with as far as, rather than thinking about something and kind of churning it around, like trying to figure it out, contemplation is like allowing the reflection to kind of reverberate, to feel it, to embrace it in a deeper way, to kind of take it within ourselves, to reflect, to contemplate, and to see what it brings up, rather than trying to figure it out or analyze it, as I think often our minds have a tendency to do. And the second part is, in Buddhist practice, I've found that it's very important to, in some way, learn how to make our practice active. And what I mean by active is that we come and we sit, we do retreats and we sit. For those that aren't familiar with this, that we have, you know, people do 10-day retreats, they do 3-month retreats. People live in monasteries, as myself, for many years and kind of do a lot of formal meditation. But I think a big part for me in leaving monastic life, what do these teachings, does this way of life, does this really have applicability? Does this have meaning in everyday life? You know, I could sit on a seat like this in front of lots of people as a monk in robes and supported by this incredible form and way of life, but who am I to tell people, you know, how to run their families or how to regulate their sex lives or, you know, the behaviors that they do in everyday life? These are things that one has to take on the responsibility for oneself. So active in the sense that we participate in some way making this practice active. And I think perhaps there's too much emphasis put on being passive. And I don't mean passive in a kind of just sitting there doing nothing kind of way, but this idea of retreating from or getting away from. If I've learned nothing in the last 10 years since leaving monastic life, I've learned that I can't run, or that, you know, that what's it, I guess it's a Pink Floyd song, you can run but you can't hide. And there's no way that we can kind of get away from our actions, from our lives. So that thing is that able to open and embrace life more and more fully. So if I just say, what does practice mean to me after, you know, 30 plus years? It's that ability to be able to embrace more and more. If you think of it as a hug, it's like, how big can your hug be? You know, can you hug one person? Yeah. Can you hug two people? When you get beyond that, unless you do like a big group hug, it's like you have to start hugging with your mind, with your heart. And what limitations do you and I put on that ability to embrace whatever it is, the fullness of our lives, the totality of what it is to be human? So these five themes are some really essence kind of things about what it is to be human. And as a reflection, as something to consider and to actively take on as a reflection, as a contemplation, it's like, again, that idea of how do we feel when we contemplate, when we bring these things up in our lives. The first, they start out as I am of the nature to age, I am of the nature to sicken, I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond sickness. I have not gone beyond aging. I have not gone beyond illness or sickness. I have not gone beyond death. So the reflection is that this is the nature. And I even like to say, well, let's take out the my. As we all, as most people are familiar with, or those familiar with Buddhist teachings, the idea of my, we work on that in ultimately there's nothing here that supposedly we can call a self. But rather than maybe go that far, to just say this body is of the nature to age. It's not, is it going to age? It's aging. For many of us, it's aging. It's been aging. And it continues to age. Illness. We don't have to talk about life-threatening cancers or things that will make terminal illness, colds, aches, and pains. It really includes the whole gamut of what it is to experience discomfort, from a common cold to a life-threatening illness to an illness that's a terminal illness that would take our lives. And finally, death, demise, our mortality. As we each sit here, we are mortal, we're not immortal. in this culture that we live in, and even people that maybe were not born in this culture, I think other than Buddhist or some Asian cultures, that there tends to be a great emphasis to deny these things. Look at all the money that's spent to not get old or to not look old, to get away from illness, all that we put into research. And I'm not, don't interpret this as I'm saying that these are not good things, that we have modern science and ways to combat illnesses to increase people's lives. But one of the things I remember Ajahn Chah saying one time, he would ask people when they come, he says, you know, doctors would come from Bangkok, that's right. I said, doctor, he says, tell me, what's the hardest illness that you're combating these days? What's the most difficult one that you've not been? Well, they'd always say cancer. He says, no, I don't agree. And they'd look at him, so what is it? And he says, death. You know, we haven't overcome death. And of course, you know, these very educated doctors would kind of be thrown back onto their own resources within themselves, as I think great masters do, and certainly Ajahn Chah did, and have to really contemplate as something that we have inherited. So rather than we got a bad deal in life, or that it's not supposed to be this way, the very reason, if we look at the whole picture as I see it, aging, illness, and death are for why? Why do we experience aging and illness and death? It's because we were born. With birth comes aging, illness, and death. It's the whole package. And so in this society, in this culture, it's amazing to see how taboo these subjects are, or how hard it is to talk about. It's kind of like silence. You know, we walk into a situation and just to not say anything is like totally it doesn't matter what we say, just say something. We can't handle silence. And on the other hand, if we talk about somebody, a parent or a friend that's experiencing those, often we don't know how to respond, how to speak to that. Well, I'm sorry to hear that, or whatever. And we make an effort, but a lot of that, I would argue, is because we've not had the exposure to these facts of life. So in Asian culture, I lived in Thailand for 13 years of my monastic life, that it didn't mean that they didn't experience grief and sorrow when someone would die, or that they didn't experience pain when they were ill, or be afraid of the illness, or that they were not in some denial about getting old. But the attitude was one of incredibly, it was very healthy. I don't know how else to describe it. It's just a very healthy attitude. And one of the examples I remember when I was a senior monk at the Western monastery in the northeast, a small branch monastery of Ajahn Chah's in the northeast of Thailand, and one of the elderly women in the village was quite ill. She was well into her 80s, and they would come to the monastery every full moon, half moon, new moon, and quarter moon days. The phases of the moon were the Sabbath days, or equivalent to what we have as Saturdays and Sundays here. And would hear that she was quite ill, and then the next observance day would come, and they'd push her in one of these little trolley carts that they push water and, you know, cow dung and everything. She'd sit on it like a little wheelchair, and they'd push her in from the village, probably about a mile and a half away. And she'd come in, and she'd kind of half crawl, half walk into a raised platform like I'm sitting on now, and she'd come to right here to my feet, and she would bow. You know, here I am, this young American, you know, at the time probably in my early 30s, and here's this very elderly, respected woman in the village, and she comes and bows to me. And I said, oh, you're still here? And she says, yeah, I thought I was going to go last night, but not yet. And it's like, and with laughter. How refreshing. How wonderfully refreshing. And it's like, but it's not in any way taking away the impact or the seriousness, but it's like, this is life. This is Dharma. This is the truth. This is what we have to live with and reflect with and consider in our lives. So I would encourage, and in my own practice too, whenever we can, we have a chance every day that we see these things in our everyday lives. We see them in others, we see them in ourselves. And probably often when we see it in others, the discomfort we feel is because we know that we're not all that different, that you and I too could experience a similar thing, could have a similar thing. So it's like a preparation. It's like preparing us for the journey. Because as sure as we're sitting here this evening, these bodies are marching to their destruction. They are going to die. But the more that you and I can reflect and see that this is a body that's dying, and there's something bigger than a body that can contemplate the body, that can contemplate illness, aging, and death, then it's like, wow, I think we're really on to something here. What is that in us that can be actively involved in looking at our bodies, at looking at what we experience in our everyday lives? So I'm of the nature to age. I have not gone beyond aging. I am of the nature to sicken or get ill. I have not gone beyond illness or sickness. And I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond dying. The next one is, all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will change and pass away from me. Whoa! Whoa! All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will change and pass away from me. I don't want to hear about that. No way. How many people don't want to hear about that? And what's so important is as we hear these things, to bring forth our best effort to open, what is this pointing to? Because I think it's very easy to misinterpret, like it's saying, well, I heard Buddhism is just all about suffering. You know, all the Buddha talked about is life is suffering. Well, I didn't talk to the Buddha. I wasn't around during the time of the Buddha that I can remember. But certainly my understanding, what's handed down, that the Buddha didn't say life is suffering. The Buddha said there is suffering. That's my understanding. I think there's a big difference in there is suffering and life is suffering. So in the same way, it's like, oh, this is all gloom and doom. You know, we're going to be separated from our possessions, the thing we love, the things that we carry about. I'm the first one to raise my hand that I go for these new, shiny, great things. I get it, and I get that hit, and it's like, and my mouth is open, and it's the next thing. What supposedly drives this, as the Buddha said, is tanha. Tanha translates as thirst, as desire, as craving. The best analogy I've heard is Ajahn Chah said, tanha, blawa kwam, ah, why? So he held his hand, he says, tanha, the word tanha, translates as an open mouth. So think about that for a moment. So the mouth is always open. No matter how much we put in the mouth, it stays open. In other words, it can never be satisfied in the ways that we're looking for. So back to the things and the possessions, it's like, well, if we're looking to be satisfied with them is one thing. If we appreciate them for what they are, enjoy them and have them, but see their true nature, it's another thing. He used to pick up his glass and he said, this glass here, he says, it's broken. And he'd take a sip. It's already broken, but don't break it. What did he mean? You know, inherent in the glass is its brokenness. It's going to break. It has its demise is built in. But that doesn't mean we destroy it. Inherent in all these bodies is death. That doesn't mean we go out and destroy them. But we learn to live with their nature, with this reality of what they are and what we've inherited as human beings. And so part of that, and in separation, when I was a monk, I came up with this kind of contemplation that I would say, another meeting, another coming together means another separation. Another coming together means another separation. So no matter how close we are with somebody, how much time we spend with them, if we interlock in lovemaking, whatever it is, that we have to come apart. If we sleep together, we roll over and part our separate sides of the bed. If we go somewhere with somebody, we part in for moments, for longer moments. And each time we part, we don't know when the next meeting will be. But if there's another meeting, there's going to be a separation. But that doesn't mean there's going to be another meeting. So this is the kind of the transiency, the uncertainty of this kind of movement. So all that is mine, beloved, and pleasing will become otherwise, will change and pass away from me. Just simply means that. If we can see the glass is broken, as we see these things as that at some point there's going to be separation, we're prepared. I certainly know that it will ease my grief. It's not going to take away grief, because I think grief is part of being human, is part of being able to learn from the human experience. But it's kind of like, a nice analogy I thought were like airbags. Airbags don't prevent accidents, all right? But they cushion the blow, all right? So in our vehicles, you know, these contemplations aren't going to prevent us from getting old or from illness or for death, but they help to kind of cushion these vicissitudes, these uncertainties, these things in life that we're all exposed to. The last part of the reflection is on karma. Or kamma. Karma is Sanskrit, kamma is Pali. And I don't know about any of you, but it seems to be, I get this sense, it's one of the words that's the, I think, most misinterpreted or misunderstood in Western culture. So you hear things, it's kind of thrown around kind of like love, you know, you love this and you love that. Oh, it's my karma. You know, well, they got to work out their karma. And I'm not sure what people mean by that, because often it is seen as retribution, as something bad that you have to work out. The word karma, scripturally in a way, as it's described scripturally, handed down historically, supposedly from the Buddha, is he described karma as action or volition. So if we think of it as karma as action, as volition, as voluntarily doing something. So what that means to me is like that makes me a more active participant, or it makes me a participant rather than this passive. I'm just like sitting here and receiving karma. It's my karma. So, you know, my knees hurt, I can't move, and it's my karma just to sit here and ache, you know, rather than, well, you know, I have a mind to reflect that my knees hurt, so I'm going to move them, or I'm going to adjust my posture, or whatever, as a kind of a simple example. So if karma is action, then it's described as good action, as bad action, or wholesome and unwholesome, and then action which is neither wholesome nor unwholesome. And if there's action, there's reaction. So it's kind of with like the birth and death. If there's a cause, there's an effect. So it's also cause and effect. With action comes the what the Buddha called vipaka karma, which is the resultant of that karma. So it's not as simple as like, you know, you do this and then if you're experiencing something in this life, then it's kind of like, well, like Ajahn Sumedho used to say about he has this big swollen right leg. He's had problems, he's had everything absolutely done that you can imagine to this leg, and it hasn't gone away. So he would say, well, I kicked my mother in my previous life. You know, this is the bad karma. I have this kind of club swollen foot that I have to live with in this life. Maybe, maybe not. But it's a way of oversimplifying, but it's also saying that there is some reason for this. For me, that's absolutely refreshing, because it gives the most explicit explanation without giving me an explanation that I've ever heard. That in other words, there's a reason for everything. Now, where I have to be careful is my arrogance. Well, I want to know the reason. You know, why was I born a man? Why was I born in Seattle? Why did I go to Vietnam? Why did I become a monk? Why am I talking at CIMC? You know, on and on and on. It's like, well, we want to know the answers for these things, and that's, I think, asking a little much. Here we take a snapshot, you know, boom, any one of you a snapshot. If we take a life as a snapshot, just like a snapshot picture, we get a moment in time captured. That's all we get. We don't know that much about this person. We can judge them from how they look, appear, and all these things. The same in a lifetime, we have 50, 60, 70, 80, you know, 90, maybe 100 years, the most for most people. So we have a snapshot of a lifetime. We don't know what preceded it, and we don't know what comes after it. So we're kind of judging on this snapshot that, well, I want to know all the rest. And maybe we can, but it seems more important to kind of know the one that we're in. And for me, by knowing about the one I'm in helps to explain the ones that perhaps I was in the past and that I may be visiting in the future. So like the past is informing the present, which will inform the future, create the future. So the five karmic reflections are, I am the owner of my karma. I am the heir of my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma, abide supported by my karma. So I am the owner, the heir, born of it, abide with it, abide supported by it. So kind of in those five kind of reflections about karma, help me where I can kind of get out of being responsible for what I do and say, think and feel, or do and say at least, and ultimately think. What this I find as a reflection helps me to once more take responsibility for what I'm doing, for my actions. It helps explain the unexplainable. But I'm not saying that it's as simple as that. It feels like a trust, a faith in me that I know there's a reason. I truly believe there's a reason for everything. But I'm not always going to know that reason, why this thing has happened. It gives the best explanation that I have found for why are people as they are? Why do certain things? Why were the people that were in the Trade Center, those are the ones that were there? Why was the ones that was going to get on those flights maybe didn't, and the ones that didn't, did? And on, all these things that we can kind of think about from that to so many situations in our lives that it's hard to have an explanation for. So it seems there's a bigger kind of thing at play here. And yet, you and I are a part of that. We have a responsibility. The next part is, whatever karma I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. So whatever my actions, good actions or bad actions, ill actions, unwholesome or wholesome, I will inherit. I'll be the heir of those actions. This is not a belief. This is not a faith. This is not faith-based. Back to what I was saying in the beginning, an active reflection and contemplation. What in that do you find meaning? For me, these are just, they're just impregnated with energy and meaning. And we talk about dharma. One of the most confusing things I used to find when I first started practicing Buddhism, I kind of had the Buddha down, you know, I got the history and, you know, the guy that was a prince and he did all these things and then he got enlightened, you know, that was cool. And then the Sangha, these people that followed the Buddha and did all these things and, you know, were kind of the community of enlightened beings that followed the Buddha. But then it would say, you know, the Dharma was Sanditiko Akaliko Ehipasiko Opaniko Pachitang. The Buddha is... The Dharma is apparent here and now, to be experienced individually by the wise. There was no concrete thing to grab onto as the Dharma. So every new book I would get on Buddhism, I'd come to Dhamma or Dharma, say, all right, now I'm going to find out what the Dharma is. And I never found it. Aging, illness, and death, is that Dharma? That we're heirs of our karma, is that Dharma? Dharma as the truth, as the way things are, as life, as all that we can kind of grow into, the truth of our existence, the way it is one of the kind of briefest, but all that we get are like indicators or pointers to what Dharma is, rather than this is the Dharma, that's the Dharma. Because I think as soon as we try to define it, it's like the problem with God, isn't it? As soon as we try to define God in our eyes, we already make something that we understand to be infinite, to be immortal, to be beyond the sensory realm, to bring it into the sensory realm. So before we even start, it's like it's failed. The same with Dharma. Before, if we're trying to bring that into the sensory realm to describe it, to try to pin it down, we start to limit it rather than to help to expand and allow it to be bigger, to embrace more of what it is to be human, of what it is to be alive. You know what this means to have a body. There's a lovely expression in Thai, and I think it comes from a Buddhist scripture source, and it goes, the days and nights are relentlessly passing. How well am I spending my time? The days and nights are relentlessly passing. How well am I spending my time? Now, I don't know about you, but I can spend a lot of time on a lot of things that don't have a lot of importance. And there's somebody in the back there that can verify that. But these, as reflections, these are helpful. They're to remind us, who in here does not need support? Who in here can go it alone? And I think another, you know, misinterpretation in Buddhist practice, and I certainly had it in monastic life, and the Theravada tradition was very much just kind of work out your own path. And that was good, but that got very lonely. And so what I really valued most in my 20 years of monasticism was the connection with the community. You know, my brother and sister monks, the supporters that were around, the people that we loved and that loved us, and our lives were intertwined, interwoven in a way that it was just this big family. And think about that for a moment. Is that not what we're missing here? Is that not why many of us are here, to find some kind of connection with community, with other like-minded folk? Because it's like we've taken the kind of material realm to such extremes, and yet we're still finding ourselves unhappy. Here's the 21st century, and how sad that we're still talking about, or certain people are talking about, missile defense and more weapons and yet another war and killing more people. And I'm a veteran. I fought war. I was in combat. I saw people die. That's how I began my Buddhist path, well, at least in this lifetime that I can recognize, was seeing my own mortality and the mortality of others. What a waste. You know, how sad. And here we are in the supposedly the new millennium. And where are we? What are we doing different? So maybe the question about what am I doing different? What can I do different? Because I think that's in this kind of idea of active practice, actively taking, it's like, what is my part? What can I do? Recognizing the limitations. A wonderful analogy I remember of, I don't know if you've ever heard of the, I think it was called The Farm. And they took all of these unwed mothers. It was down south somewhere. I don't remember the gentleman's name. They wrote a book. It was a wonderful community. But one of the analogies, you might think of it, but it's been a few, I'm not sure what's happening now. It's been quite a few years ago. But one of the analogies that he used in their community said, he says, this is like we're on a ship together on this ocean vessel. And he said, there's no passengers. Everybody's crew. Nobody can be along for the ride. Everybody has to be a crew member. So everybody has a job to do as part of the crew. So we kind of think of our planet. You know, what is our job, your job, my job as a crew member on this planet to help it be better in some way. Not in some huge way of saving the world. I mean, if you want to do that, then that's great. But what is within my, you know, reachable kind of level? What can I accomplish? And I'm sure many of you here are doing those in whatever way it is. But perhaps too often we tend to want to do it with others before we've done our own work. So what we have in this contemplation practice to help us to do our own work at the same time, when you and I become transformed by these reflections and take them on more deeply, then we can respond in situations rather than react with fear or discomfort or an uneasiness and actually bring a presence that is far too rare in these times for people to be able to just be with things in such a way. It's so refreshing. And maybe we don't need to say anything, just to be there in a quiet way, in a contemplative way, in a just a loving, supportive way. Because often maybe we try to put words in where words don't really have a place or they're not needed. So I truly believe that the more comfortable I am with these themes, with these reflections in my own life, the better equipped I am, if you will, to help others, to understand, to integrate them, to embrace them, bring them into their own lives. So I have these handouts and just maybe a few words on, well, how do we use these? And the beauty that I find with this practice is like, don't be afraid to be creative, you know? We don't just have to sit on a cushion and breathe all day until we fall asleep or till we, you know, just get so kind of, we go out of our skulls trying to kind of get it right. It's like, all right, well, if this isn't working and we've tried it for a long time, and every time I sit down, you know, I'm kind of like, I saw monks and nuns in Thailand that could sit for hours. I mean, literally hours. Nobody in this room, nobody's ever been in this hall, I would argue, could sit as long as these people could. All night. Sit. But you know how they were sitting? They got so comfortable in lotus or half lotus that they... I watched monks and nuns do that for hours. Now, maybe that's some kind of samadhi, deep concentration that I'm not aware of. But in my book, they're falling asleep. And I don't think their heads are very clear. Now, you judge for yourself. Now, please don't understand that I'm saying that it's not value. We need both. But then, how can we be creative and really make this practice, these themes in particular, an active part of our lives? We can take one, we can take them all. We can see them in others. There's so many ways that we can kind of start to reflect on them. And maybe one of the ways I would suggest is just taking one, maybe that you're a little uncomfortable, but not too uncomfortable with. Maybe like, well, I'm of the nature to age. Yeah, I get colds and I have a few aches and pains. So, you know, maybe grab one that's, you know, not too hard. And start to just be with that. Right now, I'm not ill, but my knees are really hurting. All right, so I'm going to put my legs down so I don't have to be in so much pain and I can more comfortably talk with you. Oh, thank you. I sat too long in a monastery without moving, and I ruined my knees. So taking one of these on and letting it just kind of flow through us, see what we feel. It's like when we see our reflection in a pond, in a mirror, rather than, oh, you know, I look this way, I look that way, or I'm going to change my hair, or I'm going to do this, or I'm going to do that. It's like, here I am. What does it feel like? Because we never can look at our own face. Have you ever thought about that? It's wild. You can't take your face and turn it around and look at your face. You could see a reflection of your face, I could see your face, you could see mine, but we can't actually see in the flesh our own face. We can only see a reflection or a picture of it. That's pretty wild. So we can't, because our eyes are in here and they see out this way. So when we... What do you need? Oh, I'm sorry. You can't hear back there? Forgive me. I thought I had a big enough mouth that everybody would be hearing here. So in that same way, to use it kind of as a mantra, if you will, just kind of repeat it, and then just feel it. What does it bring up? You know, I'm going to get old. Ooh, you know, no way. Well, we all thought that when we were, you know, when I was 20, I used to think 30 was old, and the 30 think 40, and 40 would think 50, and now I'm 54, and it's like it doesn't matter anymore. It doesn't matter. Now that doesn't mean I'm looking forward to getting old, but that it's such a relative thing, and we all have the life force flowing through us. And it's so hard to kind of come to grips with having a body and what it means to have a body and to be alive, and that life will expire, and the people that we love and that are dear to us, that we hold so closely, that they will separate from us one day. I mean, I feel the anticipation of grief and sadness. And yet to contemplate helps me to prepare. My father, 14 years ago, committed suicide. I'm sorry, yeah, about 14 years. I had been on a month of monastic community retreat, and I had been on a month of self-retreat out in the woods at Chithurst in England. And one of the monks came out and said, my sister just called me in some kind of an emergency. So my mind kind of danced around a little bit. I did my bows in my little hut, and then I walked down and called my sister, and she said, Pabakro is my Buddhist name. She says, our father just took his own life, just like that. And I don't know how I can't really say how I would have handled that if I had not had those years of practice. So I don't want to say, well, I wouldn't have handled it well or, in any way, but though I had those tools in place, so it helped me not be philosophical, but like, whoa, it's the unexpected has happened. It's kind of, the things we're prepared for, that's usually not the difficult ones. The ones we're not prepared for, isn't it? The ones that kind of catch us off guard. Baseball term, the curveball or the slider or whatever they throw these days. So I think that these things help us to be more prepared for the unexpected. And the more that we can prepare, the more that we can be equipped, if you will, have tools and supportive things in life to prepare us for this. I was at a funeral last week of a very, very close friend. Many of you probably know George Mumford. His oldest brother, Bill, died a week ago Monday. Just a really lovely man. He was 65. And one of the ministers was speaking, and he spoke about Bill and had known Bill personally and was talking about him. And he said, Bill was 65, he says, which is, a reasonable life these days. It's not old, but it's not young. And he says, but my son, however many months ago, he said, at 20, had been the victim of a drive-by shooting. And as he shared this, he was sharing how many, deaths and the violence in society and in the world. And he said, where do we take anchor? He used the word anchor. Where do we anchor ourselves? I thought that's a wonderful reflection. So in Buddhist terms, we talk about taking refuge. What do we take refuge in? Where do we anchor ourselves? Where do we find some stability in the instability? And I think that's an important question that we all ask in our own way. What kind of anchors, what kind of stability do I find within myself? And if we take it in anything that is bound with, you know, impermanence, change, which most everything we look around is, then we're investing in something that probably ultimately is going to somehow be disappointing, is going to let us down, not in an intentional or bad way, but without seeing its kind of true nature. Just like the glass, this could be a, you know, a rare glass with gold from ancient China or something, and it's like my whole life I've searched for this, like one of the old, what was the cup in the Grail Harrison Ford. Yeah. So you spend your whole life searching for it. And in the end, I think if I remember right, they kind of tossed it or they lost it or something. You know, all this kind of searching and all this kind of pain and hassle to get this thing. But it was a thing, wasn't it? It was another thing. And so things have a certain nature. You know, they change, they do break apart. So it's like this, it's like a tightrope that we walk, isn't it? It's between, you know, being able to love and appreciate, have things, enjoy things, be with people, but also knowing that we don't know. It's so life is so precarious. We each breathe, you know, one breath at a time. No matter where our minds are, where our bodies are, the body is like taking a breath at a time. What a wonderful reflection. That's why mindfulness of breathing is such a wonderful contemplation, such a wonderful focus, such a wonderful anchor, because it's always present. Our minds may not be present, but our breath and our bodies are always in the moment. They're always where they are. They can't be anywhere else. Is that thing inside that can contemplate, that can be, is it there? Is that present? That's the challenge, that's the training, that's the what we face as our each of our respective paths. So I offer these themes for recollection, for contemplation this evening. The last thing in it says, thus we should frequently recollect. So it kind of ends with, thus we should frequently recollect. How frequent is up to us. So I think the important thing is remembering, recollecting, reflecting rather than forgetting, because our habit, isn't it? Our habit is to forget, to push away, to want not know. And I think that's a good indication that we can have, is if we feel some kind of discomfort, whatever it is, that's probably an indicator that we need to look a little closer at something. I feel uncomfortable with talking about this, or I feel uncomfortable, and we know situations where we may be in danger or threatened some way. We've learned to trust that discomfort. But in this way, we're going against the discomfort that we may feel than something that doesn't really harm us, but that we don't want to think about because, you know, maybe it's too close for comfort. It's too real. It's too, you know, palpable in what it is to be human, to be alive. Let's just take a couple minutes of silence together. It is my nature to age. I have not gone beyond aging. It is my nature to sicken. I have not gone beyond sickness. It is my nature to die. I have not gone beyond dying. Whatever is mine, beloved or pleasing, will become otherwise, will change and pass away from me. I am the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma, abide supported by my karma. Whatever karma I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. Thus, we should frequently recollect. So I thank you for your attention this evening, and I hope in some way these themes are helpful for you to deepen your practice and your understanding of what it is to be human, to be alive. May all beings be free from suffering. May all beings awaken from forgetfulness. May all beings realize their true home. And bodies radiate heat. So I welcome your comments, questions, whatever you may have. Please.
Because I can't seem to fathom
right.
How you wouldn't think about it. I mean, I think about how you draw out, you know, graph
I
know that's not the way to do it. But I'm afraid if I just think about the attention,
maybe take it in the way of like how you aware of your breath as it flows in and out. You observe it, don't you? You flow with it. You observe its flow. You notice if it's soft, hard, long, short, whatever it is. So in the same way, take that I am of the nature to age as an example, and just kind of allow yourself to feel and flow with that. What does that mean? So thoughts will come, for sure, because the mind is a thing. It's an organ, just like the eye seeks objects to see. You know, the mind in a sense is looking to think about things, but I mean think in the sense of too much analysis or kind of a spinning out or around with, and just kind of like trying to figure something out is the best I can come up with at the moment. Maybe somebody can help me out, but I think there's a fine line between thinking about something and contemplating or reflecting on something. And that's what I hope to kind of pass along or maybe elaborate on this evening, is that there is a difference there. You know, maybe we think about if we're going to, you know, to buy a new TV or a stereo. You know, we think through it, you know, our finances, can we afford it? We kind of, you know, look at it. But we're, you know, you could say we're contemplating it, we're reflecting on it and seeing all that it kind of, the ins and outs. But I think it's when we reflect on something that has a deeper impact, that we're looking to go behind the kind of the thinking mind rather than, and so we're going more into that place. It's almost a realm of not knowing. So as I just sit here and if I reflect on aging, I start to feel my body, and I start to kind of maybe have an image of an old body or my father who now is dead and a skeleton in 6 feet under in a coffin. But before he died, he was in his 60s, so he was older looking than me. He was quite bald. you know, maybe images like that, or a grandparent that comes up, images, and just, it's like kind of letting it flow and see what comes up rather than trying to, you know, grab on to things. So I think it's being willing to experiment and being willing to just take something and feel it. And but don't struggle with that. I mean, if it's like, okay, I'm not sure what he means, I'm just going to think about it. Well, think about it and see where that goes. And then see if you can start to not think about it. You know, the best way to get somebody to not think about something is to tell them not to think about it, right? But to then step back, to move back, to, you know, go back from that and to feel it through in whatever way and just allow it to kind of flow through your body and mind and see what comes up. So it's not so much there's a formula, this is how you do it. It's like kind of like pushing you out away from the shore with a set of oars and whatever. And it's like, well, see how you do. You could do it in meditation, but more so when I say active, I mean both. You can use it as a contemplation in when you're sitting, as just as a theme, as a mantra, or in everyday life. And I think that's the beauty is to, when because it's not easy to, you know, be still or quiet in everyday life, but we have moments where we can find ourselves idle and then looking for some kind of distraction where we could just, you know, at the beginning of the day, today I'm going to just contemplate my getting old. But every time we do, you know, illness and aging, it's like they're not certain, but the certain one is the one that's always going to start kind of coming in the background, because there's no guarantee that we're going to get old, is there? So we come back to birth and death, the kind of the, you know, why are these other things? It's because birth and death. And I think ultimately that's the most important one. It's like, here's another, I stayed with a teacher for a year or so, and he encouraged death rehearsal. Rehearsing your death. Now what does that mean? It's like that you practice. How do you practice? You can contemplate ways that you might die. Maybe ways that you know, you can get as graphic as you like about it, because we don't know. But one thing I came up, I think it's a really great analogy, is to me it was like falling off a ladder, or falling in general. And I don't know if anybody does whitewater rafting, but one of the things they teach you in whitewater, I never have, but I heard this through a friend in another context, but one of the things they teach you, if you fall out in whitewater rafting, you're supposed to ragdoll. So if you stiffen up, you're going to get hurt, or you're likely to get more hurt. If you ragdoll, just let the rapids take you, the chances of getting hurt are much less, because you're going to go with the flow. All right? So kind of, you know, ragdolling with rehearsal in that if I fall off a ladder, I can either stiffen up and say, oh my God, I'm falling, or I can just kind of ease into the fall. Now, I'm not saying I'm going to be able to do that, but to me, it's a good analogy of like falling. Once it's committed, we can't, it's like, you know, we're not Spider-Man or woman or something and bring ourselves. It's like once that commitment, it's like happened, it's that movement is there, what can we do? But rather, it's like, oh. So there's a preparation for the fall. There's this, okay, I've fallen out of the boat and I'm in the rapids. So to me, death in the best that I can come up with it, with an analogy in my gut sense, is like that idea of falling. And so being able to soften and to just let ourselves go into the fall, like the preparation for that. So we're rehearsing for that. Because we don't know. We don't know. That's not me. That's just like reverberating around. We don't know. And the more that we can don't know, what we do know is that it's going to happen. We don't know when. There's in the Carlos Castaneda books talk about death as your shadow. It's always, you know, right over your right shoulder. You know, it's always right there. You know, we don't know. And the more that we can begin to know that it's there, but not know when it was going to tap us on the shoulder, it's like, what's the old saying? that we can't really live and be in the fullness of life until we come to terms with death. And then it's like, that's freedom, isn't it? What is there to be afraid of then? You know, there's pain and there's death. And all our conditioning is to be afraid of those things. But I think we're more afraid of pain, because that's a known thing, isn't it? We know pain. We've all been hurt in some way, physically hurt, mentally, emotionally hurt. So I think we're more afraid of mental pain and physical pain than we are death, because we really don't know death. And everything we hear of people coming back from an out-of-body experience or a near-death or a death experience and coming back, everything that I've heard is like, wow, I was out there, I was floating, you know, there's these lights, I just felt wonderful, I didn't want to come back. It's like, whoa, let's go, I'm out of here. Ajahn Chah used to say, the celebration should begin when we die, not when we're born. Because when we're born is when the suffering begins, is when the troubles begin. Now that's not to any way take away the beauty of birth and a life coming into the universe. But think about it, it's just like, you know, great masters help us to turn things around and look at it in another way. And so often we've all had friends or relatives or very close loved ones. It was like, you know, they were suffering so much, and it's like it's a relief that they go, because they were in so much pain. And other times they weren't in any pain and they're gone. And, you know, those are the harder ones to deal with, the ones that we're not prepared for.
Mm-hmm. And I'd like to know if you can't be sure, but do you feel that you have perhaps benefited more by being outside of the monastery than you did by being in it?
I'm benefited more by being outside of the monastery for having been in the monastery. But I can't sit here and say that I have more benefit for somebody that wasn't in the monastery, but I think it's an experience that I know has informed and enriched, and that, you know, I have no regrets. I still have longings for it. It's probably more at times when things are chaotic or I'm tired of just, you know, being and having to make decisions and, you know, look through another pile of junk mail or, you know, or whatever it is. It's just like, let me out of here. It's just, it's just become so complex. And I think we're all just kind of yearning for, you know, more simplicity in our lives. So I would encourage everyone to have some kind of exposure to that for whatever period of time they could give. You have places like in this country, you have Amaravati in England, where guests are welcome to go and stay for shorter, longer periods of time. I think the only limitation is maybe visa, or if you don't behave yourself. But I think there, and because it's like we everyone has something to offer. I couldn't be giving, offering what I was this evening without the monastic time, but also it couldn't be what it is without the time outside of this. So, you know, each thing and kind of builds and informs on it, and there's nothing I would toss out. And sometimes, well, if I had it to do over again, I never find myself saying that, because it's like, I think it's almost wasted words in a way, because I don't have it to do. I have it to do now and to learn from what I maybe, you know, from the mistakes or whatever that I made. But, you know, there's nothing I want. Because if I start thinking about changing it, then somehow I'm starting to mess with the system. You know, I think there's a lot of messing with the system, basically, that's going on these days. And I think that's where we find ourselves as a race, as a planet, in quite a precarious situation right now. You know, just think, the world is very small. It's so small, and it almost starts to, when I left the monastery, I thought, I saw 10 years or so ago, so I needed a bigger monastery. I needed the world to be my monastery. Now it's feeling like the world is maybe not big enough. Not that it's not, but it's that it feels like it's just gotten so small because of communication, because of everything is under threat in some way. You know, we keep encroaching more and more on you know, natural resources and stuff. It's like, where, you know, where does it stop?
And yet our culture especially is so fragmented.
Is what?
Fragmented.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, as somebody who tends to be a little too serious, I'm become interested in this idea of playfulness, particularly in the face of the vicissitudes of life. And it sounds all good, it sounds very nice, until we come up against something that where the mind constricts, and then it's difficult. It's difficult to dance with it in a graceful way. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this idea of playfulness in the context of this practice, particularly in relationship to the need for discipline in the practice as well.
Yeah, just the spontaneous answer that comes up is just not to take it too seriously. Because I think it's in the taking it too seriously, and I hope that came with these reflections that like the example of the old lady coming in to see me, and you still here? Yeah, I thought I was going to die last night, but you know, didn't go yet, and being able to be more lighthearted, and I think that's what friends are for, to help us to, you know, because we can't always reflect ourselves, just like we can't see our own face. You know, if we're out eating and we got a crumb or something, you know, our friend tells us we might feel it, we might not. So, you know, that's like what people that love and care for us can do is to help us, like, not take things too seriously. As far as playfulness, I mean, I have the same thing, tend to take things too seriously, but I think laughing more, being silly. I remember one of the things in my own personal work I did for when I first came out to Massachusetts. And this therapist, he called it unselfconscious hanging out. I thought it was a wonderful term. And Catherine and I do a lot of unselfconscious hanging out. We're silly, we giggle, we do playful things. And I think that's it, you know, that and you know, kids, aren't kids a wonderful example of being able, and you know, having children yourself, to be able to just, you know, be goofy with our kids and whatever.
I can't always tolerate us.
Yeah. But I think there's other, it's, and you know, maybe it means change in some ways, you know, like you being a golfer, if I may expose that, you know, maybe you take your golfing too serious. So maybe you need to go out and have a terrible game, or maybe, you know, like the time we went to hit some golf balls and I really got off in the batting cage. That was my thing. You know, that was fun. That was playful because I could, you know, I couldn't hit a golf ball, but I could hit a baseball. So I think it's be willing to be creative and find other ways to, and I think just, you know, not too seriously, and find, you know, knowing how to kind of adjust the tie. Ties would laugh in traumatic, serious situations. They would laugh. And I used to get so angry until I eventually understood that was their way of dealing with the trauma. Rather than crying and freaking out, they would laugh. That's pretty weird. But it's only weird because we didn't grow up laughing in traumatic situations. We grew up like, oh my God, do something, and you know, all this panic and craziness. Well, laughing, you're maybe not doing anything, but I think they're releasing a lot of stress. Yeah. And Kraj and Jai used to talk about it. You think about it. I know, everybody here has laughed and cried, and you know, that kind of like, you're really upset and you're crying, or your kid maybe sometimes is, you know, really crying, and then you kind of listen and all of a sudden it's kind of a laugh, but it's a cry. They're like, it's just like two sides of a coin, the laughing and crying. It's just like emotional release, isn't it? And sometimes it's, you know, by silliness or just in being tickled. And other times it's by being, you know, probed a little harder and hurting, you know. But it's they're so kind of close in a way.
Yeah, this is a question about the teachings of Ajahn Chah. I've recently been reading Ramana Maharshi, and who is, in the Hindu side, is about as close as you can get to being a Buddhist. And he talks about the fact that his practice is, to the best I can understand it, this gentleman could probably do a better job, but is to look continually at the sense of I, mm-hmm. And eventually he says that by doing that, that you will get through to a point where you see the self with a capital S, which is just a sense of presence, total presence. And it strikes me that Ajahn Chah, from what I've heard about his teachings, that's not that far from his teachings. There's more of a sense of sort of bliss or moving into a place of bliss or some kind of seeing absolute reality directly. Have I gone far enough that I give you something to work on? I get more of that with Ajahn Chah than I do with other teachers who are much more, there's nirvana and then there's, you know, but anything short of that is not that by any means, there's no kind of coming into bliss or, I don't know how to answer the question. Ask it more sharply than that.
Well, just to speak briefly about Ajahn Chah and the way that he taught, he taught very much like the Buddha, in the sense that he was brilliant at really being able to sense the need of those in front of him. And the first example that comes to mind is, Thais are very superstitious people, so they love, like monks would have a big like bowl like this, a bell or something, it would be filled with water that they had melted candles into that they did during chanting or something. So they considered this, you know, like the water when you go into a Catholic church that you cross yourself with, whatever, that it was holy water, and so they'd love to have it kind of sprinkled on them. And you find in the Buddhist scriptures that the Buddha said that this was a rite, a belief in a rite and ritual, and basically it's shallow, it's empty. But he would do it. And he's a forest contemplative monk, and this is like, you know, this isn't something in some people's view that forest monks should do. You know, they should like give people something more substantial, you know, some teaching, whatever. And he said, and so they asked him, well, why do you do this? And he says, if a chicken comes to your door, do you give it a wristwatch? You know, what does a chicken want? It, you know, can't do anything with a wristwatch, can it? So you give it grain. But human beings are above, you know, chickens. Well, some anyway. Many, we like to think. So it's like maybe that's a beginning place for someone to go further. You know, it's like that anchor. That's maybe something they can anchor in, and then something else may happen and begin to rub off. So he was always pointing and teaching to the needs of the people in front of him. But, you know, ultimately, it's like in the teachings that what we find in the Buddha, that it's always like the finger in the moon, isn't it? It's like people want to look at the finger rather than the moon. So I think it's so easy for us to kind of get preoccupied with what that ultimate, whether it's the self or nirvana, whatever that is, and when we come back to everything that I find scripturally and through the teachers that I've been blessed to be with, that there's nothing that can take the place of the experience that they're pointed, that I can individually have. And so it's always like pointing us back to ourselves. So this is to me, it's like, so that's like the ideal of a reflection, is what a good teacher does, is helps us to reflect back on ourselves. Now, I don't understand, you know, Hindu teaching that well, but they talk about, you know, getting there through the grace of a guru. I haven't contemplated that teaching enough to really understand that as, and, you know, in some way, because they're very interrelated in that, you know, Buddhism really sprung out of, you know, Brahmanism and historically was, and then Hinduism kind of embraced Buddhism as just one of the Hindu gods. You know, the Buddha sits in Hinduism as just one of like the many gods, this kind of monotheistic kind of teaching. So in the most meaningful times that, you know, in like multi-faith things and stuff, is when we could hear beyond, we could hear the experience beyond the words. So for me, it's important to, you know, the teachers you're describing, whatever, can you hear an experience that goes beyond those words, whatever it you know, that they're pointing at, that the experience that one may be describing, that even though the words may be different and the path that they got there is the experience, how closely related is the experience? Like drilling for water, wherever we drill for water, however deep we go, we find water. Water is water. As long as we drill long enough and deep enough, we find it in the earth. So like in our practice, as long as we, you know, persist and find it, then our faith, our trust, our confidence, whatever we want to call it, is that we will, you know, find that what we're looking for. And once it is, it's like it goes beyond, certainly mine to what a description is. So you find very little in Buddhist teachings about the description of what nirvana is. As it's like earlier I was saying, it's like the more we try to describe something with finite kind of terms and language and experience, the further really we are away from it. And I think that's where we can find ourselves getting into problems. And where I find as a Buddhist, it's refreshing that there's nothing I have to defend. You know, I don't mean that as judgmental as it sounds, but often find in theistic that there needs to maybe not defend, but define more, or kind of it's when you put this kind of something on a pedestal. We have an image, but an image again is a reflection. People misunderstand what this is. You know, that ain't the Buddha and the Zen masters, you know, would burn it for, you know, to use as spittoons, or burn it for firewood if it was made of wood, you know, to kind of like, hey, that's not where it is. You're looking in the wrong place. It's always kind of coming back to the experience. And of course, that's the hardest part, because it's like, that means you and I have to get in there and kind of chip away and do work. But you know, everybody that can help us, I mean, we seek that wherever we can. So perhaps in your kind of non-question, I gave a non-answer. It's 9 o'clock, yeah? One last question, comment, anybody? Please.
Uh-huh.
Now? Oh, hear that little giggle back there? Ask that lady that looks very embarrassed with the... I'm totally over the top. No. I mean, even as a monk, I mean, I'm going to be really clean here. Even as a monk, I have... I don't feel I'm justifying this, but I have always appreciated good things, nice things, well-made things. When I was a monk, I made robes, and I made them well. I made my own, I made them well. I found the best materials that I could. So it's just a part of me to seek out quality things. So I think I appreciate quality things, and it's not expense, although often quality things come at a price, of course. But it's like, for me, it's like, it's almost like when we go to one extreme, we have to come to the other. The Buddha, in the teachings, it's like Ajahn Chah used to say, rather than go to the Buddha, he used to say, well, you know, my job is really just to sit here, and I see people walking down to the path, walking along the path, and I see them a little too far to the right. So, hey, a little bit back to the left, and a little too far, hey, a little bit back to the right, and just always kind of helping them correct and get back in the middle way. And I think ultimately that you and I have to do that. And so what we have to do to learn that, and I was saying that earlier, it's like each thing is like, I look personally maybe for more satisfaction is there, but it doesn't take long to realize that it's not there. But then there's the next thing. And back to the open mouth that Ajahn Chah described, I think it's a wonderful analogy to think about that it is insatiable. That doesn't mean we won't have gratification and enjoy things, whatever it might be, from good food to good sex to, it doesn't matter, in sensual realm of pleasure. But are we ever completely gratified or completely fulfilled and satisfied? So that's why we say, rather than suffering, it's like unsatisfactoriness or not fulfilling. And then sometimes it's just dukkha is just downright suffering, pain, sorrow, whatever. But other times it's just that kind of little disappointment or lack of, this isn't really it. I remember when I was very young, I used to always be looking for another subject in school or something that I thought was going to be it, a sport or whatever. I had this feeling when I was very young that I was looking for something to be it, whatever that it was, that it was. When I entered military life, you know, I flew helicopters, I was an officer, and that was it. And then it definitely wasn't it when I went to Vietnam. And then I went into monastic life. And that was the biggest piece of it that I've found. But now it feels like I'm discovering another part of the it, whatever that it is. And a part of my path is having things and enjoying things, but also learning that, you know, ultimately they are not fulfilling. And I think, you know, if I had more money, I would probably have more things. And I don't, you know, I try not to judge myself on it and just let it, you know, kind of be what it is. And the hardest thing for me is think if I get my mind set on something and then to know that I can't get it or achieve it, get it more than achieve it, that then I really have to work to kind of step back from, because I get pretty stubborn when I get my mind set on something.
I thought it would relate to like oversimplification.
Yeah, no. No, but I think, you know, Catherine and I think we do live a very simple and frugal life, but it does, you know, we enjoy things, we enjoy going out to dinner and you know, whatever, simple things, but, you know, not like, you know, overly, and I think that's just, you know, part of her nature and mind, you know, somewhat in simplicity, but it's like everybody has to, it's the easiest thing is to judge someone by, you know, what they wear or what they drive or who they're with or whatever. It's like, you know, who are you and I to judge in a sense? Because everybody is finding their own middle way, aren't they? Or has to find their own middle way. And it's like, when you start thinking of karma, well, everybody has to work it out in their own way. But definitely not oversimplified, no. Well, thank you so much. It's been a great joy to be with you this evening. And I hope to see you all again.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.